Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, the Samam Varnam, chapter 68, the marriage of Samba, text number 6. Drisvanu Davita Sambo. Dhatarastran Maharataha. Pragriya Ruchiram Chapang. Tastao Simha Avaikalaha. Jisvanu Davita Sambo. Gatarastran Maharataha. Pragrihya Ruchiram Chapang. Tastao Singha Avaikalaha. Drisvanu Dhatvata Sambo. Dhatarastran Maharataha. Pragrihya Ruchiram Chapang. Tastao Singha Avaikalaha. Visva Anudavataha. Who were rushing toward him? Samba. Dhatarastran, the followers of Dhritarashtra. Maharataha, the great chariot fighter. Pragriha, seeing. Ruchiram, beautiful. Chapam, his bow. Tastao, he stood. Simha, a lion. Eva, like. Ekala, all alone. Translation, and eventually some purports by the followers of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Seeing Duryodhana and his companions rushing toward him, Samba, the great chariot fighter, took his splendid bow and stood alone like a lion. Or a simha. Please repeat. Seeing Duryodhana and his companions rushing toward him, Samba, the great chariot fighter, took up his splendid bow and stood alone like a simha. Text 7. Determined to capture him, the angry bowman led by Karna shouted at Samba, "Stand and fight! Stand and fight!" They came straight for him and showered him with arrows. O best of the Kurus, as Krishna's son, Samba, was being unjustly harassed by the Kurus, that darling of the Yadu dynasty did not tolerate their attack any more than a lion would tolerate the attack of puny animals. Purport. Commenting on the word Achintyabha, Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna, Samba, the glorious son of the Yadu dynasty, was endowed with inconceivable potencies as the son of Lord Krishna. Om jnanat minambasya gananjana shalakaya chakshu unmilitam jena tasmai sri guruve namaha jaya sri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda sri advaita gadadhara srivasadi gaur bhaktavinda hare krishna hare krishna 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 hare 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 rama hare rama 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 hare hare. So Simha, of course, is lion. Who's seen a lion before in the flesh? They're very powerful creatures. An African lion probably stands about 1.5 meters at the shoulders, which is about as high as that lock on the door. And their mouth, you could probably easily fit your head inside it. They're very powerful creatures, very muscular, and more than that is their attitude. Lions are very aware of their strength and power. When a lion roars, he establishes his propriety of the jungle. I am the king of the jungle. Very powerful. And when a lion prowls, he doesn't care about anyone. He's prowling. Just like I remember I went to the zoo once in Auckland, New Zealand, with my auntie. And I wanted to see the animals and so forth, to see the different types of bodies. And we went to the lion's cage, and they were all sleeping. They had a kind of a rocky hill, and they'd just lie around on the hill. They didn't care about anyone. They were just nonchalantly taking rest on the hill. And this is what they do a lot of the time. You know, they tend to gorge themselves. Maybe we're familiar with this. You gorge yourself, like, feast like anything, and then take rest. Anyway, they're doing their left side down on the rocky hilltop. But then feeding time came. It wasn't a proper feeding time. It was the time, they do it basically for the spectators at the zoo. Because lions, you know, their eating patterns, it's feast or famine. You know, they get an animal, they bring it down, and they just gorge themselves, and they go to sleep, and they might not eat for a few days. But anyway, it's because people come from the zoo and they want to see the lions in action, they feed them every day. But what they do is they get these bones, which practically no meat on them. So it's basically pretty frustrating for the lion. But anyway, they throw these bones over onto the island, and these lions just immediately get up, and they're like, and they go down and they're prowling around like anything. And they've got this look of absolute determination on their face. And they're powerful. You can see them just prowling around. And yeah, it's pretty intense. Very intense, actually. There was this glass wall. Glass was about that thick, thankfully. But you could stand right basically a few feet away from the lion as it prowled. Sometimes it'd bash up against the glass. And they were powerful creatures. And in Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th canto, within the Sringadeva pastime, Narasimha, Narasimha, man, lion, combination. Prabhupada, one of the texts, one of the slokas says that Hiranyakashipu was like a big elephant, and Narasimhadeva was like a lion. Now, an elephant is a huge creature. And sometimes in the jungle, Srila Prabhupada explains that the lion and the elephant have a fight. And shit, like if the lion stands up to the height of the lock, the elephant stands just below the ceiling in terms of its size. It's an incredible creature, elephant, powerful. Still the lion wins. The lion grabs hold of the throat and tears it out. So, lions are the king of the jungle. This is accepted in all cultures, actually. It's just a fact. Eagle is the king of the sky. Lion is the king of the jungle. So, Samba, his mood was like that. You know, at the Svayambhara marriage ceremony for Lakshmana, he just entered in, grabbed her, and left. She wasn't even that inclined. He just said, anyway, this is my will, and my will be done. So he just grabbed her and took off. And he was so nonchalant in his mood. And all the warriors chased him. And then they said, stand and fight, stand and fight. Tista, tista, iti. Stand and fight, stand and fight. And when a Kshatriya hears that, he has no choice. The code of chivalry. Force him to accept the challenge or surrender. So Sambha wasn't about to surrender. So he turned around and he faced them like a lion facing some jackals. You know, sometimes when the lions bring down a kill, some jackals come and want to scavenge. Or sometimes the jackals catch something. Yeah. And they're kind of feasting. And then the lion comes along. And sometimes the jackals might put up a fight, but the lion doesn't care. He just wastes them. No problem. I once said this. I got an email saying, it was newsflash. In Thailand, one city in Thailand, there was a fight stage between 25 dwarves and a lion, African lion. And the owner of the troop of dwarves, he was sure that his fighting dwarves would be able to overcome the lion. But within a few moments, the lion had killed like 15 of them. Just throwing them around and tearing them open. Anyway, it turned out to be a hoax. It wasn't real. But you get the idea. So the lion would just throw off the jackals, the puny animals. Yeah. Insignificant in the face of the lion. So somebody's turning and facing soldiers like that. And they will do better with him. As we will see. Now, how did this all come to be? Sambha is the son of Krishna and Jambavati. And Jambavati, of course, is Jambavan's daughter. You know, and there's some Vintaka jewel controversy. Krishna ended up fighting with Jambavan for, I think, what, 21 days? And Jambavan realized, despite his incredible strength, because he's actually from Ram's era. Yeah. You know, Ram was millions of years ago. Krishna was 5,000 years ago. So Jambavan was from Ram's. He was in Ramayana, actually. And then he remained. And he ended up with the Shantaka jewel because Satyajit's brother took it for a ride in the forest. The horse was killed and he was killed by a lion. The lion left the jewel there. No, the lion took the jewel to its lair. Jambavan killed the lion and took the jewel and gave it to his small child. So Krishna found his way to the jewel and had a wrestle with Jambavan. So powerful. Jambavan wasn't used to having such a challenge. Jambavan's huge and Krishna's man-sized. But still, Krishna was giving him a fight. And Krishna wasn't getting very fatigued. But Jambavan, after 21 days, he got fatigued. And then he realized the covering was removed from his consciousness. And he realized, actually, this is my Lord. This is the same Ramachandra coming in as Lord Krishna. And after that incident, Jambavan pledged his daughter to Krishna. Please take her as your wife. Jambavati. And then, so she is one of Krishna's principal wives. And born to her is Sambha. And Sa Amba. It's a long A. Sa Amba. Sambha. That means, that name is given actually because he was a bit of a mummy's boy. He was very close to his mother. Amba means mother, and Sa means with. This is explained in Krishna book. So they'd spend a lot of time together. He was also known as Jambavati Sukha. Still, he was very powerful. And just see his nonchalance, his determination. And he wanted Lakshmana, Duryodhana's daughter, as his wife. So he just went and took it. Of course, like many of Krishna's pastimes, we can appreciate this and read about it, but we shouldn't try and imitate. That's not proper behavior. That's really not proper behavior. Of course, there's different types of marriages in the Vedic culture. There is Gandhava marriage, mutual attraction. Generally, the boy and the girl will meet in the forest and agree on their mutual attraction and in that way marry. There is this Rakshasa marriage where the Kshatriya will just kidnap the girl whether she likes it or not. Sometimes she'll be desiring it, like Rukmini was, desiring Krishna to kidnap her, and sometimes not, like in this situation. And there is also the more sattvic marriage, which is generally arranged and approved of by higher authorities. Mm-hmm. And this is actually considered the best. Because, of course, such a relationship has to be entered for the right reasons. Yeah. If life is meant for self-realization, then one should approach marriage for purification, as explained in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, the yogi, he acts for purification. Yeah. All his activities are simply purification. He's thinking that I have certain desires and tendencies and a nature within me. My goal is pure devotion. Unalloyed, unmixed with material desires and material motivations. But right now, I cannot manifest that due to my conditioning. Therefore, let me engage in a progressive process of purification. And therefore you have the progression of ashrams. And when it becomes apparent or that that ashram is necessary for the individual, it's very important how the person enters into that. It should be done with a service attitude, actually. A service attitude. Because one enters for pleasure, then he's going to be frustrated. Or she's going to be frustrated. Because there will be some pleasure. Just like in life, there is some happiness. And there will also be some toleration required. There's this movie, this devotional movie made about a South African man. His sister's a Hare Krishna. She's a very serious, sober person. And she's married to an African man, which is quite controversial in South Africa. And he is like outgoing, boisterous, a bit of a performer, kind of like Adam, you know? Very extroverted, happy-go-lucky type of character. You know, he plays accordion, he chants, he's a very warm, loving person. And it's an interesting mix. And he just says, frankly, on the video, he said, marriage is an institution of tolerance. Now, sure, there's some good times, but there's also some, there's a lot of duty required, a lot of toleration. Because naturally, you have your own will. You have your desires, you have your way of doing things. In the marriage situation, you have to combine. You have to work with another person. Devamrita Swami says that many times we get frustrated, you know, because we think, why don't people do things my way? And you get so frustrated that you think, what I'll do is I'll get married. And then that person will do things my way. And then of course we get married and we get frustrated. And then we realize, hang on, no one does things my way except me. So practically this is a realization that is required for advancement in spiritual life. How to cooperate. And ultimately how to serve. Because how to serve, if we really go into it, it means actually acting according to the will of another, not your own will. Which is very difficult for the conditioned soul, because thou ishvara above, ahambogi, ahambishvara. We want to be the controller, we want to be the enjoyer. This is the conditioned soul. So how to actually become a servant? This is our goal. So in that situation, one should, it's best to get blessings. It's best to enter in a service mood. Because then when there's problems, you can think, this is my service. If there's a struggling period in the marriage, it's my service. Therefore, I have to, I'm not going to escape the situation because it's inconvenient now. No, I'm going to keep doing it. Because ultimately, this is Bhagavatam explains this, pleasure and pain, or happiness and distress in this life, meted out according to our past life, our karma. So by your activities, you cannot change what is coming to you in terms of happiness and distress. And you see this practically, like in his book. Anyway, Dale Carnegie writes about some crippled people. He was walking along, and then he heard all this laughing. It was at the train station. He heard all this laughing and like kids laughing, and then he saw them. They came up the stairs, and they were on crutches. A lot of them were on crutches, and some of them being carried by others. And they were cripples. They were on a day trip. They had a minder, a carer. And he talked to the person who was minding the crippled children. And he was saying, "Why these guys are very happy, even though they're crippled?" And he said, "Sure, it's just the human nature." Because, in the beginning, when they first suffer their injury that cripples them, they often get depressed and down. But then once they reconcile that, okay, this is the way it's going to be, they become happy. They just become like any other boy or girl. Because happiness and distress are coming anyway. So even if you are crippled, you still get some happiness. Even if you're perfectly healthy, you still get some distress. So in the marriage situation, when the two people combine, the tendency is to blame the other person. There's distress in my life now. You are the cause. But that's not true either. Don't blame the deliverer of your karma. That's not the mature thing. And actually the ashram is for purification, how to serve, and how to get realization on the ultimately the illusory nature of bodily attraction. Eventually the couple will see each other just as devotees. That's the idea, according from what I've heard from Bhakti Vidyapurna Swami. That's the process. That the materialistic side of the relationship eventually, if the relationship is performed properly, falls away, and then they become just devotees beyond the bodily designation when the relationship is very mature, and it's like two devotees working together. So of course Sambha hasn't done like that. He's done that, taken that. He hasn't got blessings, he's just seen something he desired and gone for it. And it's different in his case, because of who he is and because of the culture he's a part of. He's going to follow through. many times we see in the material world, especially in this modern Kali Yuga, that people do that. They fix their mind on some person and they just try and get them, But then, of course, once you bring down your kill, the person then abandons it. Somebody's going to follow through. And also, there's no divorce. So if he makes his choice, he's bound by the responsibility of the whole thing. Now, the Kurus, they are not very happy. Mainly because their power and authority has been slighted by a member of the Yadu dynasty. He just come in and just... Anyway, he flipped the bird at them, and taken off, And that's like, for a Kshatriya, that's a real blow to the ego, you know. You think you can just do that? We'll show you. But of course, Bhishma, he's reasoned clearly. He said, well, you know, now Sambha has touched her. Therefore, she cannot be married to anyone else. No one else will accept it. So we should not kill Sambha. But we should capture him to teach him a lesson and to prove that we are powerful. So what is this? Cultural protocol that if a woman is touched by a boy, if a boy snatches her, then she is used goods, basically. This is basically what the cultural element is stating. Nobody else will accept her. Now, why is that? It's actually promiscuousness. Well, having many relationships is not glorious in the Vedic culture. It's not glorious, nothing to be proud of. You know, many times men and women are proud of how many people they've been with, because it shows their prowess at attracting people. So that's nothing to be proud of. Actually, that damages the psychology a lot. Especially for a girl, it said that one of the prime qualities is chastity and devotion to her husband and her family. And in order to have that, having too much experience of alternatives is not so good. There's even studies been done by modern university students, professors and so forth, that the more choices a person has, the less happy they are. Because what's choice to make, and if I make a certain choice, then what about the other choices, and maybe I should change my choice, and this and that. It doesn't bring peace to the mind. And it's like, I was on the tram the other day, just coming back from the city, and there were these two girls sitting just across from me, and they were talking, you know, talking about all their conquests and all the activities they'd been up to. I was quite surprised, actually. the bartender, he called me in the middle of the night and said, come over to my place, you know. So I just started walking right across the city, you know, just one after another, all these stories and stuff. It just went on and on and on. I was like, whoa, this is like full on. And then I was thinking, poor girls, you know, because one day they're probably going to want to settle down, you know, naturally, and then nest and, you know, lay some eggs. But the thing is, the situation, because of their conditioning within them, they're always going to be thinking, what about that other guy? You know, now it's a little inconvenient, things aren't exactly going my way, maybe I should change, you know. It gives them that option. And it's harder, and they can't really be devoted to one because they've had so many. It's really damaged the psychology a lot. They've mixed their psychology and their attachments and done so many people. And eventually they become kind of callous and hardened over. The heart becomes hardened. And the capacity for actual chastity and devotion is destroyed. And along with that, happiness. Because happiness doesn't come from sensual stimulation and feeling good about your attractive potency. That's very superficial happiness. Real happiness is going to come from deep, fulfilling relationships of love and commitment and devotion, mutual devotion. And ultimately, the happiness comes from spiritual life. So Devamrita Swami, he explained, I was listening to a lecture recently called Frustrated Love. He's given in India. And he's talking about, you know, the cultural protocols for interaction between men and women. And he explains that the whole mode of goodness way of doing things, what it does is people get their satisfying relationships. They have a strong family bond. the duty elements. Their duty element is essential in any community. Even just interacting on a day-to-day level with your fellow devotees, you need to have a sense of duty. It's my duty to treat this person in a civil way, even though yesterday they fried me up. It's my duty to control my mind and to reduce the offensive fault-finding mentality, to stop gossiping. Because the mind is like that, you know. The mind senses a certain slight of this person's, doesn't respect me how they should, or whatever. They do something offensive, and then the mind starts to think of ways to retaliate, the things I can say to, cut that person down, and this and that. And part of the discipline of living in a community is to actually dissolve that within the mind before it comes out on the tongue. And to actually say, no mind, that is wrong. So duty is necessary in any type of relationship. And then if that duty is there, actually there's a lot of good times. There's a lot of good times. If you've got the community of the sincere souls, good-hearted people. And the Vedic culture is meant to produce good-hearted people, honest people, to keep us honest. That's why also a promiscuous life, or a history of promiscuity, especially in male-female dealings, tends to destroy character, actually. Damages character. So that's why chastity is an important thing. And then, then you have a family, the relationships are close, or you have a community and the relationships are close. The friendships are real friendships, through thick and thin. I'm your buddy, I'm by your side, whatever you need, I'm there for you. The mother, the parent-child relationships are all proper, it's all nice. The Russells are all there, and the human heart becomes satisfied on one level, because you can't fully be satisfied by the phantasmagoria of dealings in this mundane world. Because it's all going to pass. Like straws in a river, sometimes come together, sometimes go apart. That's like relationships in this world. But still, because we, are bound in a time, place, circumstance, situation, that's what it means to be a conditioned soul. We're associating with other souls who are at a certain, they've got their bodies going through the process from birth to death. So we have different relationships with the other conditioned souls. And there's a certain part, we're social creatures, so we desire those relationships. And therefore, they should go on in a proper way. And then the love won't be frustrated. But at the same time, it won't be fully satisfied. Because full satisfaction comes from a devotional connection with Krishna. That relationship is eternal. And that relationship fully satisfies the self. No limited being can satisfy you. You should understand that. So don't try and invest your hopes and dreams in a single person or even a group of people. It puts a lot of pressure on the other person, actually. A huge amount of pressure. You are supposed to provide me with satisfaction. It's not going to happen. You're limited. Therefore, the jiva is meant to get satisfaction from Krishna. So when relationships go on properly, with blessings of the community, in the context of a community, because just like, these days, two people get together and they generally go off in their little world and they do their thing. And then there's some problem and, they don't have the social support. So much better, if it's all done in the context of a caring community. Then, when there are problems, the community is there to support. So this is the best type of marriage according to the different types. The one that's done under guidance with blessings and generally with some recommendation from higher intelligence. We need perspective. Guidance is so important. We need perspective on our activities, on our journey. Because we can't see the forest for the trees most of the time. There's trees all around us. We don't even know what direction we're supposed to head in. So then often what you do is climb the tree and look down. Survey the landscape. How do we do that? Practically, we take guidance. from somebody with higher intelligence, from somebody detached from our particular situation. And they can say, actually, you're acting like this, and this is what you really should do, and this will be the best thing. Have you thought about the long-term situation? We're bound by what? Three things. Time, space, and thought. And our perception is completely subjective. Often we can't think long distances into the future. We get so caught up with a temporary desire. We do something foolish. We don't see, at that time, at that moment, we don't see the long term. So many times. So to take guidance from higher intelligence is to get that perspective. And that will save us from doing foolish things. Every devotee needs guidance. So important. We also need to feel like we have people we can trust to give us guidance. When there is genuine shelter, there can be genuine surrender. If there is no genuine shelter, you can't surrender. Not really surrender. So, Sambha has acted very independently. That's not recommended. For us, different time, different circumstance, different personality. Sambha's Lord Krishna's son. So ultimately, you know, what we're trying to do, what are we trying to do here anyway, in this Hare Krishna temple, following this Hare Krishna path? What are we trying to achieve? Very good. On point. Yeah. Basically, we're trying to develop a perfect service attitude. I was reading the Vyas Puja offerings to Devamrita Swami, because I'm his disciple. So I was reading the offerings of various god brothers and sisters, mainly the devotees I know. So much inspiring nectar is there. Just the mood of devotion and surrender and the sincere determination to advance in Krishna's service. So I was reading that, and there was many quotes. The devotees give quotes from Bhagavatam often, and also quotes from things that the Guru has said to inspire them. One devotee, I can't remember exactly who, was speaking about it's Mahavan Prabhu in Wellington. He was talking about a class Devamrita Swami gave about the teenage years of devotional service. When you get a bit older in Krishna consciousness, you start to begin to know the ropes, and when you start to enter your teenage years, you've been around for more than 10 years. He says, devotees manifest the same symptoms as a teenage body manifests. What's that? Casting off all dependence on higher authority. I am independent. Which is actually very foolish. But he was saying, Devamrita Swami was saying that it's an important point to remember is that we're not actually trying to become the master. We're not trying to hit a certain point where we know the process and we've got mastery of it. No, we're trying to more and more become attached to the lotus feet of our spiritual master and attached to the lotus feet of Krishna and become a servant, not a controller. It's a subtle point, it's a very essential point. Because many times we approach, you know, Krishna consciousness, the idea that I'll get mastery of it. And But it's not actually the case. And we subvert the process. We still try and control and enjoy, but in the name of Krishna consciousness. We try and get some position. We try and you know, it's trying to get position, influence, fame, adoration, distinction. We try and do all these things because we want to control and enjoy. But that's not the real thing. And so we should not miss that point. That's actually what we're trying to achieve. And an essential element of actually achieving that is having a guru. Right? Or having authorities in your life. Every devotee needs relationships with juniors, with equals, and with seniors. And to have a genuine relationship with a senior is so important because we learn how to submit ourselves. And this is ultimately what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to achieve that service mood, that submission, ultimately to Krishna. And the guru represents Krishna. We should not be independent. Yeah, at the same time, we should not be fully dependent. Yeah. Prabhupada did say, this Krishna consciousness movement is meant for producing independently thoughtful men and women. So it's good. It's good to like have a brain and be able to think and know the Shastra and be able to discriminate according to the Shastric principles. But at the same time, we should never think ourselves independent of guidance from higher personalities. The guru is not there every day to tell you how to tie your shoelaces and how to do this, how to do that. You know, even like we have this urban yoga center in the city. Sometimes I ask my spiritual master, you know, what about this? Do you think I should do this? And he goes, anyway, you just sort it out, you know. You just say it. It's like, kind of rolls his eyes. Let's just see some results. That's what he says. You figure out the process. I'm like, okay. At the same time, other things, he's very strict. You know, he's very emphatic about, don't forget to do this. You know, focus on this. This is very important. And I shouldn't take it. Oh, he said, just figure it out. And therefore, I just do whatever I want. No, it's not like that. In certain areas, he's asking me to think and make decisions and do things. In other areas, he's and of course, if you go out of line or off track, then you get that person to put you back in. Because often we can't even sense when we've gone off course. You know, it's like we're sailing across the big ocean. And there's this ocean all around, you know. We don't know what direction we're heading half the time. We get no perspective. Or we're walking through the forest, we can't see the forest for the trees. So we don't even know if we're heading in the right direction. But the guru can say, I see you're going off track. Just correct like this, correct like that. Align. The devotee should want to align with the approval of genuine, qualified authorities. You know, when you sense a disapproval from authority who's bona fide, then you should feel very bad and want to fix, correct it so you can actually achieve their approval. Because ultimately that's what personal guidance means. When you take shelter of somebody, you're concerned about their approval and disapproval. If they're disapproving, then you have to say, well, okay, how can I correct it so they do approve? If they are approving, you think that's very good, you feel happy. Actually, you feel happy and satisfied. And you continue in that way. Because they have your best interest in heart. Okay, so there's some points on these verses. Soon we will see the fight. Next we will see the fight between Samba and the five warriors headed by Bhishma. Samba puts up a good fight actually, and they have to admit frankly that this boy is wonderful. And of course, what happens is he gets captured. The Yadu dynasty becomes furious, wants to go to war, but Balaram says, "No, let me pacify them. Let me go and speak to them, and I'll pacify them, and then we'll see what happens." Balaram gets insulted and he exhibits his incredible power as the personality of Godhead. Any questions or comments on these points?